Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply. Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com. Chicago Sports Station.
All the world's a stage when your name is Michael Jordan. So the spotlight that shines brightly on your triumphs also burns intensely on your mistakes. On Sunday in Orlando, Jordan had more than a bit part during the closing scene in Game 1, fourth quarter. Bulls up 91-90. 22 seconds to go. So the Bulls up one. Michael's got the ball in his hands. Not any longer. Kenny, to the former Bull, Horace Grant, Magic up by one.
When Michael came back from playing baseball and Nick Anderson stole his rock, the reason that stood out, you hadn't seen anybody take Michael's rock in a long time. It's like watching Muhammad Ali in the second half of his career when someone lands a punch on him. It's like, whoa, you mean you can hit this guy?
Jordan still had a chance to deliver one of his patented buzzer beaters, but instead he threw it away.
He dropped it out of bounds.
This just in, Michael Jordan is human. In crunch time, gives up a steal, throws the ball away, Bulls lose.
Intense stuff from The Last Dance, and the voice you heard in there, one of them, was that of Dr. Todd Boyd, who is joining us now on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline, Alpamonte Ford in Melrose Park. I got to take a deep breath before I give the actual job description here. Dr. Boyd is the Catherine and Frank Price Endowed Chair for the Study of Race and Popular Culture, Professor of Cinema and Media Studies at the USC School of Cinematic Arts. I feel like I should keep going. The Master of Disaster, the King of Sting. He is with us on The Score. Hello, Dr. Boyd. How are you?
I'm good, sir. How are you?
I'm good. I want to engage maybe a little meta-criticism before we talk about some of the nuts and bolts of what we're actually seeing. Millions of people are watching this documentary because of what's going on right now. This is a shared communal sports experience that was completely unexpected with the attention that it's been garnering. What's the effect of that? What do you think, watching it now, having been a part of making it and now watching it, what matters about how this documentary is being consumed?
That's a very good question, and I've thought about that a lot. It reminds me of, you know, when I was growing up, there were three networks, ABC, CBS, and NBC. And, you know, basically they're three things on television. I mean, you'd have some local channels depending on where you live, but there's three major networks. And whatever was going down was going to happen on one of those three networks. And so even if you were watching one of the other two, and one was sort of at the center of the conversation, everybody was familiar with it. It's not the way we consume media now. I mean, social media, multiple channels available for people to watch. People have whatever that they're doing in their own lives. And so to have a situation where it seems like a huge percentage of the population, or at least it feels that way, has been watching this and, you know, commenting on it and posting photos and memes, it feels like a communal experience, of course, specific to the moment we're living through. So that part of it's, I think, excellent. On the other hand, because of the circumstances we're living through right now, at least in California, it may be different in other places, but, you know, lockdown over the country, you can't really go out in the public and talk about what you've seen. So everybody's watching it and everybody's experiencing it, but then the sort of aftermath of it takes place on social media, but you can't really go out in the public and engage it afterwards the way you can while you're watching it.
It's seeing all of this juxtaposed with the modern NBA and what it's become and how the nature of NBA stars has changed in large part due to the interactiveness, interconnectedness of social media and understanding a little bit that their role as citizens is something more important to some of these stars. What do we now know about Jordan, perhaps with some of the new context, now that we can see this and compare it to what we are seeing in sort of the postmodern NBA? Are there any new conclusions to be drawn about all of these things that happened so long ago?
Well, I think, you know, when you think about it in that way, Jordan was pre-social media. You know, if we stop talking about Jordan after 98 or even, you know, when he came back and played for Washington, you're still early 2000s, and that's a different story. But, you know, what we're looking at in The Last Dance, you know, all this existed before social media. I mean, the Internet was brand new. If you think about, you know, players who have come after Michael to, you know, perhaps sit in that same seat, Kobe Bryant, LeBron James, these are athletes. Kobe in the second half of his career for sure was a figure very visible in social media, and LeBron's, you know, entire career, it seems like, has grown up around, you know, the Internet, social media, things like that. So Michael is a superstar from a different era. It's hard to believe, but that was, you know, if you go to 98, 22 years ago. I think, you know, when you look at Michael and all those stories about, you know, things he did in practice and, you know, I mean, I knew all these things because, you know, this is part of what I do, but the public didn't know. And so I think now, because of social media, people just know a lot more about athletes because athletes are able to, you know, dictate their own narrative through social media. Michael's a guy who was a superstar at a time when the narrative was being filtered through, you know, mainstream media. And so it's different because now I think people have a lot more connection to their superstars. For a lot of people, what they're seeing in this documentary was unknown. And I think that's why looking back at it, it's really informing a lot of people. If we were to look at a contemporary superstar, somebody like LeBron, he's more visible in social media on a regular basis, it probably wouldn't seem as revealing because a lot of this information would already be out there.
So many things happened concurrently with Jordan's rise in sports, and perhaps the most important was the acceleration of the evolution of hip-hop culture. And I'm 50 years old. I went to college in 1987, not really having heard much hip-hop music. I just wasn't into it. I wasn't exposed to it at that time. And meeting people in college, especially my friends from New York, who said, because I had heard of Run DMC, and then I started listening to it. I'm like, all right, something's going on here. And that leads into the deep dive into the New York stuff and Eric B. and Rakim and Big Daddy Kane and then Public Enemy. And I actually would share a story that actually when Do the Right Thing came out in 89, at the theater where I was in the Chicago suburbs, when I went to see it right when it came out, two rows in front of me, I realized at the end of the movie was Craig Hodges, who was sitting there actually watching that movie. And the explosion and the watching it all unfold in front of us. Was Jordan ever actively a part of that? Because the essence of it and some of what's significant about hip-hop culture always seemed to be something Jordan kept at arm's length, even while he was selling shoes.
Well, I think if we look at Jordan in terms of the period when he came into the culture, the mid-1980s, you know, 84 draft, you know, the Air Jordan sneakers are very much a part of hip-hop culture, but that is something that would evolve and connect over time. I always like to point to the fact that, you know, when Michael went to the All-Star game in 85 wearing his Air Jordans and, you know, an entire sort of Air Jordan fit, as they say. A lot of people didn't like this. He's also, you know, he has gold chains on. And these were the things at the time that people associated with hip-hop culture. which was itself, as you point out, you know, in its really early stages, especially outside of New York. But, you know, I mean, Michael's a year older than I am. I was into hip-hop from day one, but I might have been a bit more enthusiastic than some of the other people my age. Over time, this would grow. I think when people think of, say, basketball and hip-hop culture, they think of the Fab Five, which is, you know, from the early 90s, certainly influenced by Michael. I think it's just the point that Michael came along. It was real early in that basketball-hip-hop connection, and ultimately the manifestation of that link would be Allen Iverson. And so, you know, in that famous play when Iverson, you know, crosses Jordan over much later in Jordan's career, around the time that The Last Dance is set, Iverson became the symbol and the focus of that connection. Jordan is a bit early in the process. There are some hip-hop elements, and I think it's been cool to use hip-hop music as a way of scoring this documentary, but Michael's a little early in the process, and I think just a few years' age difference would mean that by the time he gets to the, you know, near the end of the second retirement, he's a few years older than the people who are being associated with hip-hop, Shaquille O'Neal, you know, I mentioned Chris Webber and the Fab Five. So there's maybe some years difference, and Michael's at the front end of that. And then, you know, Iverson, of course, is even younger. And so going forward, you have a lot of guys coming into the NBA straight out of high school starting in 1995. So the league gets to be younger, especially fast. And by this time, I think Michael has moved on.
Jordan also was able to transcend some of the frictional aspects between established NBA culture and, as you say, as the NBA got modern and more stylized. The couple examples that come to mind would be length of shorts, when they had the length of shorts police out there and they're actually measuring them because David Stern was concerned. I had a conversation with David Stern on these airwaves, in fact, after the controversial decision to airbrush Allen Iverson's tattoos off of his body for the cover of Hoop magazine. Then there was Jerry Krause at one point talking about the cornrow hairstyle. And there was a belief that that was something that was just an image that they didn't want. And it's just more chapters that the NBA has always had in this push and pull with a discomfort with that aspect of the culture. And in large part, it's one of these things that it never really happened with Jordan in any specific way. Is it because he was great? Is it because he was somehow figured out a way to be anodyne in that regard? But he knew where to position himself, so that wasn't ever really an issue.
Well, as I'm saying, a lot of that has to do with age. You know, Jordan is the guy who's associated with the longer shorts, but it's the Fab Five in cultural memory who's associated with sort of fully adopting that style. Jordan's the first guy to wear long shorts, but when the Fab Five wore them, they were longer and even bigger. They sort of reflected this hip-hop style. You know, the cornrows, those things had been popular back in the 70s. They became popular again around Iverson in the late 90s. Again, as I'm saying, Michael was older and then having moved on. You know, all of those issues that came up with basketball and hip-hop, late 90s, early 2000s, the NBA was playing hip-hop music throughout the arenas. Hip-hop had a very prominent place, but there was controversy around hip-hop style, you know, and of course, ultimately, in the mid-2000s, you get the dress code. A lot of that is Michael's era, you know, his age, the time that he came around, and how those cultural changes happened, and Michael was so far above even the league at a certain point in terms of his image. He was a global icon, and so a lot of things that may have applied to people younger than him just didn't really apply to him because he was seen as a superstar on such a massive level that he had his own lane and everybody else was dealing with those style controversies that came about because of hip-hop.
We're talking with author and professor Dr. Todd Boyd here on Sports Radio 670 The Score. something, an image from this documentary that stands out to me, and it's something when we had Bill Cartwright on the other day, we talked to him about it, that really I just, my jaw drops. When, here's Patrick Ewing now. Patrick Ewing is talking and very honestly and openly about Jordan, you know, being snatching his soul, you know, stealing away his dreams for so many years in so many heartbreaking ways. And what is Patrick Ewing wearing? He's wearing the Jumpman logo on his shoulder. We think of the term "and," and we have abstracted the term. But when you think about being branded, Jordan put it on him right there. And you talk about owning somebody. He's branded him there. And I just, it was incredible to me to think about that. What's the significance of that logo? Even if it's not necessarily having to do directly with Jordan himself, what is the meaning of it? What may be the lasting meaning of that particular logo?
Well, I mean, think about how many people in history have had their own logo, you know, not very many. The logo, the Jumpman logo, I think just embodies everything that Michael Jordan meant to the culture. You know, it starts with the sneakers, and of course we have a whole sneaker culture now that grew up around, you know, Air Jordans, a huge sneaker culture. The Jumpman logo embodies the fact that, you know, as a basketball player, Michael was incredible. But he transcended the basketball court. He became an icon across the globe, you know, endorsing numerous products. I mean, a Jumpman is Nike and then brand Jordan. But it just embodies the fact that, you know, he became this superstar who went beyond his sport and became recognizable just across the world. And that cultural legacy is part of his overall legacy. We're not just talking about him as a basketball player. We're talking about him as a basketball player and a cultural icon. And there's only a really, really small handful of athletes in American history who could claim both of those mantles, athlete and icon. So he's in a really, really small group, and I think that Jumpman logo just kind of embodies all that he represented culturally, as well as, of course, speaking to where it started, which was on the basketball court.
Last question for you, Dr. Boyd. One of the running themes in this has been Michael Jordan's single-minded ruthlessness. And it can be thought of in, there's no right or wrong answer. It can be a remarkable and impressive desire to win. And we've talked to people who say they want to watch with their kids to show their kids, this is what it takes. This is dedication. This is intense professionalism. And it also has been depicted as kind of a pathology, is what's wrong with this guy? And who's like this, and is, you know, inventing some of these windmills at which to tilt, you know, is this okay? So I guess the question for you is, this image of his, of this almost this human insatiable competition shark, the rings are there, the trophies are there, and the ends might have justified the means, but is it positive or negative for sports culture or for popular culture that this is who he is and was?
I would say it's American. That's what I would say. I wouldn't characterize it as positive or negative. It's American. I think what Michael represented was especially American desire to win at all costs, to dominate. You know, you said at the ends justify the means. It's interesting, and I think a lot of people would like to think, oh, you know, he lifted weights and he got better after the Pistons kept beating him, and he just, you know, was relentless in pursuing his goal, and, you know, maybe that is true partially, but I think what people are seeing now is, you know, Michael was not a nice guy. I think it's kind of interesting. A lot of people have been going after Isaiah Thomas, but, you know, why is it okay to berate and humiliate and abuse people in one instance, and it just be considered the drive to win? And in another case, Isaiah is considered the worst person in the world because he walked off the floor and wouldn't shake Michael's hand. That's a bit hypocritical. I think what you see in both cases, Isaiah, of course, native of Chicago, Michael, you know, they wanted to win, and winning is sometimes not pretty. And maybe the public doesn't recognize that this is what it takes to win an NBA title. It becomes an almost maniacal focus. There's a lot of, you know, things that transpire that are not positive, that are not life-affirming, that are kind of dark and negative and just problematic from a human standpoint. So I think the lesson is, you know, when you talk about this pursuit, this is an American pursuit. A lot of people are very comfortable saying that, you know, the ends justify the means. If this is what you have to do to win, then so be it. I mean, Michael's a product of his environment, as we all are. And so when I look at it, I don't think of it necessarily as positive or negative. I think of it as this is the American way. And for that moment in time, Michael Jordan represented it in ways that were not always nice and neat and clean and polite, but were the opposite of all that. And so, you know, a lot of people will look at that and say, you know, I want to win, and they'll excuse, you know, certain bad behaviors in the pursuit of it. And maybe other people will look at it and say, you know, I want to win and hopefully try to be a better person about it. Is that possible? One does not know, but I think it's an interesting lesson in one's method and one's approach, and whether or not if you win at the end, it kind of erases all of the negativity that may have led up to it.
I hadn't thought of The Last Dance as a mirror being held up to all of us, but indeed that's what you described. This is fascinating stuff, Dr. Boyd, and I really appreciate you taking the time to join us today.
Thanks for having me.
That is Dr. Todd Boyd, and I could do another three segments on this, believe me. But man, we got to make room for Len Casper because we got stuff to talk about with him. He is coming your way. We're going to check in with our friend Len, who's been actually really busy doing a whole bunch of stuff. He's got a lot going on in all this time. So he's going to come say hi next on The Score.
This is 670 The Score, Chicago's number one and most listened to sports station, period. Thanks for keeping us on top, Chicago.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.